Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Elle Nash on her debut novel, Animals Eat Each Other. Elle Nash is the founding editor of Witchcraft magazine and a fiction editor at Hobart Pulp. Her work has been featured in Volume 1 Brooklyn, The Fanzine, Cosmopolitan, Elle, The Offing, Enclave and other places. And her debut novel, Animals Eat Each Other, we're going to be talking about today. Elle, welcome to Little Atoms.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
So how would you describe Animals Eat Each Other, first of all?
I have heard it described as a visceral, raw, and gritty book. The book explores the relationship between three people and sort of the dynamic between all three of them, how it changes, and how manipulation works in their relationships with each other.
And where did the sort of genesis of this book come from then?
It started as a short story in an online workshop I took in probably, I think, 2012 or 2013. I kept expanding it. I was working with my mentor, Tom Spanbrow, at the time. And as we kept unpacking it, like as I was working with him, I realized that it just needed to be a novel. I was really interested in the ways that, female friendships are formed, especially between non-hetero identifying women, and how close and how quickly, but also how becoming really vulnerable can cause the relationship to turn really quickly. How friends and lovers hurt each other. So that was really sort of the genesis of that novel. I really liked exploring that and exploring how different. So the main character, she is a part of this threesome relationship or a throuple. These two people are already dating and she enters it. And I really liked exploring the difference between how the man in the relationship has the power dynamic with her and how she has a different power dynamic with the woman in the relationship and kind of how those interrelated.
Tell us something more about how it developed from that short story then, because you said you filled it out, but it was a process of, filling the story out. But, one of the things that's noticeable about the book is its style is very pared down. It's written in short chapters. We'll talk about something more about the chapters in a moment, but the style of it is very terse, and I wonder if that was already there or did that sort of develop through the expansion?
That's a good question. I think maybe it was a little bit of both. This is my first novel and I was, really learning a lot about myself and my voice, that I was trying to develop as I was writing it. And one thing that I really love to do in my fiction is focus on these little intricate or intimate details, the physical exchanges that people have. I really love fiction that feels vivid to me when I read, so I try to focus on that when I write. And one of my goals as a writer is to basically cause, I have an emotion or feeling or a flittering of something in my head that I feel. It's like an atmosphere, And I want to be able to transfer that feeling onto the page so that someone else feels that. And so that's, I think, why I worked in these pared down chapters and how you'd say it's kind of terse and, I wanted to sort of replicate that type of mood, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that is exactly what it does. And I wanted to say something about the chapter titles. I'll let you explain, because the chapter titles are interesting as well.
Yeah. So when I had originally thought about writing this book, I wanted to explore the tenets of Satanism. And I was like, at first I was like, okay, maybe I'll try to have every chapter title be like a tenet of Satanism or something like that. But it didn't end up working out with the structure. So like, as I was writing it, I was just thinking like, this is the chapter title. Like, this is what the chapter is about. Cause I didn't want to just do like 1, 2, 3, or 4, you know? I didn't really think much of it when I wrote it, but I've heard so much feedback that people really love the chapter titles too, so it's really kind of good to hear that.
Yeah, it's almost as if the chapter titles work in a sort of, you know, micro-fiction way as well. They're all like, some of them are little tiny stories in themselves almost.
Yeah, like a couple of the ones that I like is like, the thing about boundary issues is that you end up fucking your friends or maybe everyone you know. Or if you don't leave your hometown after high school, you'll get bad tattoos and do lots of drugs. And they're like kind of like funny little quips that I just had thought of that I thought would work as like a chapter title.
Could we talk about the setting both in time and place as well? So it's set in Colorado Springs, first of all. Why there?
Well, so Colorado Springs is a place that I grew up, so I was really familiar with it as a place. And it's kind of interesting because one thing that annoyed me about living there was that when everyone would visit, like tourists, they were like, oh, like Colorado Springs is so beautiful. There's so much nature. There's a lot of like poetry from people who are local to the area that talk about how beautiful the Rocky Mountains are. And like, frankly, when you live there, you kind of see that it's not. There's a lot of there's a big disparity between like the haves and the have nots. And it's really clear in like the infrastructure and the more poor parts of town. There's also 5 military bases that surround the town. So it's there's a lot of transient people, not transient as in homeless, but transient as people like who come in and out of the city. Like there's people who just, they only visit for a few years and then leave. So when you're growing up there, it can feel a little bit like you're stuck and everyone else is going. And so I wanted to kind of capture that feeling in this book of a person who felt stuck and like didn't know kind of where to go outside of that.
I want to talk about the time setting as well, because it's set in the early 2000s. Now we're going to talk about a narrator in a moment, and one of the sort of structural elements of the book is that she's obviously narrating the book from a point in the future and looking back at something that has happened. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to talk about why that particular time period.
Well, I think just as a millennial, I start to look fondly back on the early 2000s as this really special moment in like music and culture, just, you know, like for me specifically. So maybe it's kind of like selfish. And I kind of love the idea of exploring it culturally, like sort of memorializing that early 2000s moment. Because I think for a long time, there's a lot of hype around like the 90s, like, oh, 90s toys and 90s music, you know, like Kurt Cobain and 90s advertisements and like 90s clothing is so, it's like fashionable again. But there's not a lot of attention paid yet to the early 2000s, which is like huge JNCOs, jeans, nu metal, which everyone kind of seems they like love to hate. There's a lot of, or like the mall goth culture, there's a lot of distaste towards it. Like it's not quite cool yet. So I kind of just wanted to like memorialize those moments of like my own coming of age, like those like the icons of style and like feelings of like growing up in that time period.
So the narrator of the novel, she's to begin with unnamed, or I mean remains unnamed in terms of her real name.
Yeah.
And she has given a name by one of the characters later on, but let's talk about the decision. I mean, I guess thematically the naming of her by this particular character is relevant to the theme of the book, but let's talk about the idea of her being unnamed to begin with, first of all.
Yeah, so I really wanted the character to function as a mirror or like a reflecting pool, and I wanted to do that not just in the book, so the other characters get to name her and have this ownership over her. They get to project kind of like their own desires onto her, which is why she's nameless. So she's like taking on metaphorically this new identity that they've given her. But at the same time, like outside of that, like the meta is that I really try to write the characters as unjudgmentally as possible because I wanted Lilith herself to be able to reflect back what people read into it. Like Lilith herself or the unnamed character becomes this reflection for like who is reading her. And I wanted people to be able to relate to her as much as they could. So I felt like leaving her nameless was a really good way to do that.
Let's talk about who Lilith, historical Lilith, is.
She was the first wife of Adam, which isn't present in like the Christian mythos, but in Jewish mythology, she was considered the first wife. She was made from the same clay as him, and she didn't come from his rib. So there's this idea that she's made on like equal footing as him. And then the story goes, and it's been interpreted in many different ways, but the story goes that she refused to submit to Adam, so she was cast out of the garden herself. And then there's lore about her that she's basically like a night demon. She represents like all the bad things about women, like seducing men or like taking away firstborn children. But in other lore, she's also represented as like this figure of rebellion, of someone who wouldn't, you know, submit to authority and that sort of thing too.
And let's talk about who, I mean, in two ways, because normally I would say let's talk about who our narrator is, who our character is. We could do this in two ways, who she is before and after she becomes Lilith, I guess.
Yeah, so before Lilith, I would say that, so she's a young 19-year-old girl who is just working part-time right after high school. She doesn't know what she wants to do with her life. Her father's been dead for some time, and her mother is a single working mom who struggles to sort of keep things together after the death of her dad. Her mom like uses pain medication to sort of deal with her problems, and as a result, and the unnamed narrator does too. So that's who she is before she meets this couple, and she's alienated and she wants to feel like she's a part of community, of like a family. So I think it's like when she meets this couple, she kind of gets thrust into that because they also have a child. So she gets to experience this feeling of having a nuclear family with them. As a result, she sort of becomes like what they want. Like she's like, okay, here's a place, here's a path I can take. And so she just kind of follows that path that they delineate for her.
Matt and Francis, or Frankie, tell us more about who they are.
So, Matt and Frankie are young parents. They're about the same age as Lilith, and they have a child who is, I think, around 1 year of age, I would say, in the book. I think he, like, grows throughout the book. And they're basically just people who they're struggling to get by as young parents, sort of living on their own. Matt is also a tattoo artist, or like a budding tattoo artist, and Frances is just a stay-at-home mom taking care of the baby. And they have like their own relationship, but they're people who are like, they're open and sort of, I think, looking for an escape from the stresses of their daily lives too.
And so our narrator embarks on this sort of fraught three-way relationship with the two of them. What does she, I mean, initially, what does she want out of it? What does she think she's going to get from this?
I would say she's just looking for like a sense of belonging. She appreciates the attention that she gets from them, but she's looking for a place where she feels like she can just like be like belong. Like she almost is willing to be owned, so that way she can be belonging, like belong to someone in that way. Because she feels alienated from like her family and society at large. She's has problems with substance abuse. She's constantly trying to escape herself, and like so for them, it kind of becomes this way to escape.
And she, of course, in not too long, starts to push against the boundaries.
Right. She starts to wonder who has all of the power in the relationship, whether it's Matt or Frankie, because Frankie has like a bit of a temper and is sometimes cruel to Matt. And the unnamed narrator sees this and there's something in her that wants to pull closer to Matt. And then there's a moment in the book where he and Seth pulls her closer to him. And so she's aware of, like, the betrayal that takes place, but participates in it anyway.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Elle Nash, and we're talking about her debut novel, Animals Eat Each Other. And Elle, I want to talk about the depiction of bisexuality in the novel, something which is often not particularly covered in, even still, in contemporary novels. But what's great about your depiction here is it's not even really what the novel is about in terms of a narrator's defining characteristic. It's just... Mm-hmm. It's just who she is.
Yeah. Growing up, you know, I read a lot of books about, I guess, they were coming of age books about LGBT characters in which their sexual identity was like the main source of their identity. And I was really tired of seeing that, honestly. Like, I think it has its place. I'm not saying that it's bad, but I really wanted to read about and develop a character who this was part of her, but it wasn't like this defining characteristic. She was already okay with herself in this respect. It wasn't something that she needed to explore about herself. She just simply was. And she didn't need to like put a label on it. It didn't need to be described as something special. You know, it just simply is a natural function of her life. And I think I just really wanted to express that on a page.
And also related to that, now, normally I would say, we're not going to talk about what happens in the novel and give too much away. But I did want to say that what I also really loved is that this is not also a story in which our narrator goes on some sort of character arc and learns a lesson. Basically, it ends up pretty much with her in the same position as she was when she started.
Yeah, as I was working through the book, I realized that I wanted the book to feel realistic, like a real story that someone could have gone through. And functionally, when people are dealing with substance abuse issues or bad relationship patterns, especially in this short of a period of time, people don't often learn their lessons, or maybe they do, but it takes a very long time. You know, you can only help a person who's willing to help themselves, that sort of thing. And I think that, you know, the reality is for the vast majority of people who do suffer from these sorts of problems, it's a lifelong struggle. It's not something that, you know, at the end of the book, you're changed. It's something where, like, maybe you do. You end up in the same place a year later, not having necessarily learned anything. And I wanted that feeling that nothing changes, that feeling of, like, dissatisfaction to kind of come through towards the end.
talk about a couple of the themes of the book, and first of all, can you talk about sort of themes of identity and the self that you look at in the story? Our narrator is part of her, I've just said she's not going on a journey, but, you know, part of what's going on in this relationship is her experimenting with different aspects of identity, I guess, taking on different versions of herself.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, when you're a young person and you're trying to figure out your place in the world, you're more free to explore these aspects of yourself and, like, make mistakes doing it without necessarily having these, like, huge consequences. You're not responsible for anyone yet, which is an interesting contrast to the couple who they do have a big responsibility. You know, like, they have this child that they have to look after together. So for them, the stakes of losing each other is much higher than of, like, Lilith losing them or losing something else in the process. So I kind of wanted to compare and contrast those things. And I don't know, I think it's kind of universal. Like, at some level, most humans are on a search for themselves or exploring themselves, you know, at some point or other in their lives. You know, it's kind of almost like kind of like the basis of most religions is this, the analysis of the self and their place in the world or in the cosmos, you know.
I was going to expand that and say that also you've just described her, you know, being in this position where, you know, Matt and Frankie have adult responsibilities. They have a child to look after, and Lilith is on the cusp of adulthood. She's, you know, she's 19. She's embarking on a, you know, a very, let's say, adult relationship with this couple. But at the same time, is in a position, she, you know, she has a job, she works, but she's also looking towards the rest of her life, not sure what direction that's going to take her in as well. And you know, not, I don't know, what am I trying to say here? You know, there are certain adult responsibilities that perhaps she's not ready to experience yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, honestly, when you're 19 and you're like kind of on the precipice of the world, there's this expectation that you should be knowing where you're headed and start to get serious about your life and have to be like a responsible adult. But it's almost an unrealistic expectation for such a young person. Being like in my 30s now, you know, if I were to speak to my early 20s or 19-year-old self, I would just say, like, it's really not a big deal. Your 20s are kind of there for you to fuck up a little bit, you know, explore yourself more. Like, you don't have to worry so much about trying to find, like, your adulthood yet. Like, it's okay to work towards things, but you don't have to be too serious about it yet. And then I feel like once you hit your late 20s to, like, your early 30s, that's when, you know, you want to have something more stable, like, in place, I think, you know. It's tough. It's tough being 19 and thinking that you have to have the world figured out, because you really don't. And even then, like, when you get older and you meet other people of varying ages, you kind of realize that, like, no one else really has the world figured out, you know. When most people turn 30, they end up doing something else completely different anyway. You can reinvent yourself at any stage of the wheel. You know, nothing has to be set in stone, you know, quite yet. So, yeah.
As we've discussed, this is a novel that has, you know, it has a, shall we say, dysfunctional relationship at its centre. There is substance abuse, manipulation, cruelty, humiliation. These are quite perhaps difficult subjects to write about. And I know, as well as writing, you know, this novel and short stories, you write non-fiction as well, and you've written non-fiction about eating disorders and things. And I wondered if, which register you find it easier to write about, shall we say, tough subject matter in, non-fiction or fiction?
I would say fiction, because I'm really allowed to explore things thematically in a way that, like, the real world doesn't necessarily allow you to. And it's not that writing about myself is hard, you know, like, with nonfiction. I've written essays about having an eating disorder and that sort of thing. It's not that, like, broaching myself or analyzing myself is difficult. It's more just that fiction feels more flexible as a form. And it's funny, because the more and deeper I've gotten into writing fiction, it's almost harder to go back to thinking about writing personal essays. Like, I've done a few of them, but, like, with fiction, you can really just, you can do anything, you know. It's just, it feels a lot more free.
Is there a pressure, I think especially now in the sort of social media age, especially particularly on, you know, young women writers, young women journalists, to put themselves at the centre of the story in that sort of way?
You know, I do think there is that pressure. I was recently talking with a friend who had a book come out this year about, she was talking about writing essays like for book promotion. And there is a part of me that feels like I don't feel like I have to be confessional to promote myself, and I shouldn't necessarily like, it shouldn't have to be that way. Like, you know, I'm practicing like a historical art form, which is literature. Or fiction, you know, literary fiction. And I shouldn't have to necessarily like, you know, wallow in the confessional world of like hot take essays and that sort of thing. And it's not that I'm against it. I think if people want to write that way and that's what they feel like writing, then they absolutely should. Some people prefer nonfiction, and I think that's great. But it feels a little bit like, I guess whenever I see like male novelists have books come out, I never see their, you know, confessional type "this is my life" essays. I never sort of see that happen, and maybe it's just because they're not seeking them, you know. But
no, I think they're not being asked.
Yeah, it seems that there's more of a focus on that, and you know, to be quite honest, like maybe it happens because there's a market demand, and if this is how you're going to reach like your audience and that's what they want to see, it makes sense that some people do want to serve that. But you know, it's true, like I've kind of gone back and forth. Like I love the opportunity and chance to write essays about things that I feel like writing about, but if the pressure goes, it's like, I don't want to feel like I have to confess my life or anything like that. And even, I think even in regards to the book, like I've noticed, I've had a lot of questions that ask, they kind of sideways ask, like if the book is about me or about my life. And, you know, it's not nonfiction. That's not, you know, if I was going to write about my life, then I would have written a memoir, and it's not a memoir, you know, it's literary fiction. So I think you're right that there is this pressure for women to sort of have their, like, have it be a diary or a confessional thing. And it doesn't have to be that way, you know. I can just simply say I don't want to write those types of essays and not do it, so.
To finish us off, can I get you to read us a little bit of the novel?
Sure. I think I will actually read from the prologue, which is just the very beginning of the book, and then a few paragraphs into it, so. Matt placed the knife on my face, pressing down against my lips. He wanted me to lick the edge of it, to push my tongue up against the serrated edge so he could watch the way the muscle in my mouth looked against the metal. With his other hand, he held my neck to the floor. The one who tied me to the coffee table was his girlfriend, Frances. Her hand was on my thigh, small and smooth and bird-like, occasionally caressing back and forth across my leg as I lay on my back, pressed into the living room carpet. Frances was naked and sat with her legs under her, tourmaline hair falling to her lower back. We were drunk again, their baby asleep in his crib in the bedroom down the hall. I squirmed my hips to get comfortable, inched my head left to keep my hair from pulling. Matt's fingers, thick and calloused, wrapped tighter around my neck. The pressure in my skull increased in slow heartbeats, the room fading into an inky black vignette. His eyes, the kind of blue you only see in nature documentaries about very cold places, stared into mine. I stared at the bridge of his nose to seem like I was staring into his eyes. At moments, I would catch his gaze and almost see a flash that I was a real living thing, visceral and bleeding. I wanted to be validated the way everyone does. I ended up between a floor and a knife, between a man and the mother of his child. This was before I understood what it was like to be held close, to the ribs close. Close like I was the only one. That summer, I worked at Radio Shack, an adult strip mall, 3 miles from my mother's place in Lamplighter Mobile Home Park. We moved to Lamplighter when I was 8, after my father died from sudden liver complications, leaving us with a garage-sized inheritance of 1970s knickknacks, old photos, and debt. My mother was a caretaker for the elderly, and although she worked through most holidays, her income alone couldn't pay the mortgage on the Rambler they had bought when they first moved to Colorado Springs. All summer, my mother had been prodding me to find a job. I just graduated high school and had no immediate plans for college, instead investing my time in a growing obsession with snorting Percocet. I was 13 the first time I thumbed one of my mother's pills, a Vicodin, only one, because I feared she might notice it was missing. I remember carrying it back to my bedroom like a fragile tooth, and I placed it under my pillow with the same excitement that used to come from exchanging body parts for quarters. I brushed my teeth and washed my face in the hallway bathroom, and when I came back, the pill was still there. I swallowed it with a glass of water, and at first felt very nauseous. Then a warmth spread from my belly into the rest of my limbs, and I felt comforted in a way I hadn't in a long time. It reminded me of a moment when I'd woken from a nightmare as a child and crawled into bed between both of my parents, cradled by the largeness of their bodies and the smell of their sweat, both sweet and stale, like old cigarettes.
So I've been talking to Elle Nash. We've been talking about her debut novel, Animals Eat Each Other, which is out in the UK now from 404 Inc. Elle, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thank you so much.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.